Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming out and helping us launch our 15th annual practice period. That's amazing. At least I think that's the number. I'm not very good at numbers. It's 15 years. And thank you, Ruth, for not running away and being willing to stay and be our shuso for the next 6 weeks. It was a bit of a hard sell last night, but we prevailed. For those of you who weren't here, there's a partly scripted and partly improvised ceremony by which the shuso, or head monk, tries to back out of the seemingly overwhelming responsibility. And Ruth expressed worry about making mistakes. How many people have ever worried about making mistakes in the Zendo? Well, did you notice I just left my stick in the kitchen? I had to run and get it. So mistakes are kind of fun. They wake us up. Mistakes wake us up. So, I'm going to start today with a story. It's a Chinese folktale. A folktale which became the subject of koan number 35 in the classic collection of 100 koans called the Mumon Kan, translated as the Gateless Gate, compiled by Zen Master Wumen, or in Japanese, Mumon, which means Gateless Gate, or No Gate. And each koan almost literally means case, almost like a legal case, but in this case, they're cases for us to investigate and look deeply into. So each koan is a story, often a dialogue, sometimes just a question, and they're most of them, vast majority of them, are derived from encounters between ancient Chinese Zen masters and their students. Some of them are very, very cryptic. And they are designed to kind of nudge us or knock us off our, or out of our conventional ruts of thinking, of dualistic thinking. And most koan collections include, for each koan, a commentary by whoever compiled that particular collection and a verse. The reference to a folktale in the koan literature is pretty unusual, but the story itself is universal, as you'll see. So once long ago, there was a Chinese man named Chang Qian who had a beautiful daughter named Qian. As a child, she played every day with her cousin, a handsome boy, of course, named Wang Zhao. One day, as they were playing, the father said jokingly to his nephew, "When you grow up, I'll marry you to Qian." And both children took him very seriously and believed that they were betrothed. However, when Qian grew into a lovely young woman, a rich man of high rank, quite a bit older, asked for her hand in marriage, and her father agreed. She was dismayed, and her cousin, Wang Zhao, was so angry, he decided to leave home. The next day, without telling anyone, he packed his bags, and at nightfall, he set out in his boat down the river that flowed past their town. Just as he reached the outskirts of the town, he heard a voice calling him. And there was Qian running after him. He rowed over to the edge of the river and she climbed in. They traveled, we don't know, a day, two, 3, until they came to a distant province where they settled. They married, they had 2 children, and they lived happily for 6 years. But Chiryan was always sorry that she'd left her parents in that way, and she missed her home. So after 6 years, she really, really wanted to take her children to see her parents and to ask their forgiveness. So her husband agreed, and they took the journey back. When they arrived, the husband, Wang Chao, went to the house first because they weren't sure how they'd be received. And Chiryan and her children stayed in the boat. When Wang Chao presented himself at the door, his uncle greeted him warmly, saying, "Oh, I wonder what happened to you. Have you been well? All these years I've wondered." Wang Chao replied, "I don't deserve your kind words. I've come to beg your forgiveness." His uncle looked puzzled. "What do you mean?" Wang Chao said, "I thought you might still be angry with me for taking Chiryan away. We've been living in Chu province all these years." "Chiryan?" his uncle said, seeming to be dumbfounded. "Yes, your daughter." The nephew was beginning to wonder if the old man had lost his mind. "What are you talking about? My daughter has been right here, sick in bed, ever since you went away." Now Wang Chao started to get angry. "Don't mock us. Your daughter has been my wife for 6 years. We have 2 children and have returned to seek your forgiveness." The two stared at each other. Then the uncle motioned to his nephew to come inside. There in an inner room lay Chiryan, pale and thin, still beautiful. Her father said, "She can't speak, but she can hear and understand." And then he spoke to her in a kind of gently teasing way. "Wang Zhao tells me you ran away with him and you have 2 children." She smiled, but said nothing. Wang Chao said to his uncle, come with me to the river. I see this woman, but your daughter is in my boat at this moment." So they went to the boat, and there was Chiryan. She bowed to her father and asked his forgiveness. And then he replied, "If you really are my daughter, I have nothing but love for you. But I don't understand this. Please come up to the house." When they had almost reached the house, they saw the pale, sick Chiryan coming to meet them, smiling with joy. As the two women met, they merged into one, more beautiful than ever, with no trace of illness or sorrow. Her father said to the husband, "Since you left, she has lain like that in a stupor. Now I know her spirit had left her." And then Chiryan herself said, "I was never aware that I was at home. The day I saw Wang Zhao go off angry, that night I dreamed I ran after his boat. That's all I remember. Now I'm not sure. Which was the real me? The one that ran away, or the one that stayed home?" So the koan in the Mu Meng Kan doesn't include the story at all. This story comes from an account written by Lafcadio Hearn, who was a very eccentric Englishman, right? Who lived in Japan, married a Japanese woman, became a complete Japanophile and wrote a lot about Japanese culture. And he particularly loved ghost stories. In the koan, the story is referenced only because everyone knows it. In the koan, it's just Zen master Wu Tzu asked a monk, the woman Chur'en and her spirit separated, which was the true Chur'en? So that's all that's given in the koan. But we could tell countless versions of this story, couldn't we? You know, one for every turning point in each one of our lives. One for each time we left rather than stay, or stayed rather than left. One for each, whether we stayed or left, a home, a relationship, a career, you know? For every one of those turning points, there's the self that has lived this life and the other possible self that we would have been if we'd taken the other turn, right? We've all got those turning points. Which is our true self? Sometimes we wonder, right? Particularly when we've been dissatisfied with this life, right here and now. Ruth and I periodically have conversations that go something like this. Ruth, how am I supposed to train as a Zen priest when my livelihood and vocation are as a writer? As a writer requires me to run around the world giving talks and making appearances. Kate, how am I supposed to nourish a creative life and write some poems now and then when being a Zen priest in a lay sangha seems to require being an event planner, website geek, and answering a constant stream of emails like everyone else does these days? Ruth and Kate, we both really deeply believe that our Dharma offering, that the expression of our practice as Zen priests, is none other than the totality of who we are, including the part that's feeling pale and neglected at the moment. And this is the koan that's been given us by our poet teacher, Norman, by ordaining us and our contradictions, to live our way to the answer, which is the true self, the priest or the poet, writer. Maybe not one, maybe not two. So these wonderings arise for all of us at times when we're in states of frustration and self-pity. Self-pity as opposed to self-compassion. The eyes of self-compassion see that to have taken a different path, we would have had to have a different family, different schooling, a different socio-cultural environment, a different time in history. We would have had to be a different person. The eyes of compassion see our life in the matrix of all being and allow us sometimes to let go of fear and live our particularity, the beautiful, terrible details of our lives, and boundlessness at the same time, our boundless true nature at the same time. So I've called this weekend, the theme of this weekend, an undivided life, because there's so many ways we become separated from ourselves. You know, as little children, we spontaneously express ourselves, right? And we quickly learn what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to those upon whom we depend utterly for our physical and emotional needs. Initially, our parents, our primary caregivers, and later, our extended family, those in school, and the society around us. We learn to shape our behavior to win approval and to avoid disapproval. It's natural. We learn what makes our parents uncomfortable. It may be our anger, our sadness, our exuberance, our intelligence, or our slow-wittedness, our beauty, or our plainness. See, it depends on their conditioning, how they react to us, right? In some families, you're scorned if you're smart. In some families, you're scorned if you're not. It's very confusing, especially if you get one message at home and another message at school. We take it, but we don't know that when we're small. We don't understand how that's relative, how that's conditioned. We take it as a given, and we adapt accordingly, if we're able. If we get mixed messages, or if it seems there's nothing we can do that will win their approval, we get confused. We might act out our frustration, or we might just shut down. Those expressions of ourself that are rejected go underground into the shadows of our psyche. They become our ghost selves. A sure sign that one of our ghost selves is stirring is when we're really bothered by that very quality in someone else. See if you can notice this. If you're really annoyed by somebody who takes the center stage and seems to hog all the attention in social situations, you might ask yourself if there's a ghostly self in you that yearns for a little bit more attention. Oh, no, I'm not like that. You may react at that idea, but aren't we all entitled simply to take our place in the world, fully expressing our own particular being? In our teacher Norman Fisher's book, Taking Our Places, that's what he maintains, is that we must grow up to simply take our place in the world, to become fully mature human beings, neither overinflated or deflated, just as we are. So then there are many social and cultural forces that continue to shape us as we enter the world beyond our families growing up. They tell us who we should and shouldn't be in ways that may or may not conflict with what we learned in our families. To truly grow up, we have to take our place outside the confines of our particular family karmic drama, even of our collective sociocultural karmic drama, and see our lives as part of a vast network of cause and effect that we call the human condition. When we do this, our hearts open and we can feel compassion for ourselves and for others. When our deepest desires are thwarted or suppressed by external forces and we have no sense of choice or agency, our ghost self can go into a kind of suspended animation, like Chir Enns did, sometimes for years or for our whole lives. The story of Chir En is included in this new collection called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. Only she's called Senjo, which is the Japanese pronunciation of her name in here. And each of these stories is given with a kind of commentary or reflection by a contemporary woman Buddhist teacher. And this one is by Linda Ruth Cutts, who is currently abbess of San Francisco Zen Center. And she says that the conventional elements of this story mirror many of the situations that brought me and many other women to practice. Like Senjo, we may have grown up in circumstances in which we had little agency, where familial, religious, cultural, gender, and social pressures were strong, and where meeting the prevailing expectations was conveyed as more important than anything else. Like Senjo, we may have experienced great love, great loss, and deep disappointment. Conditioned by this difficult environment, we try to relieve our pain in unskillful ways, resulting in feeling divided and distanced from our once lively self. Like the two Senjos, unaware of each other, one drained of energy, sick in bed, without speech, the other an active wife and mother, yet riven by contradiction and separation. Eventually, we begin longing to be whole, for something for our real home, something real for our true home. Sooner or later, our ghost selves have a way of leaking out through the cracks in our armor. When resentment and bitterness ferment inside us, they can spill out when an interaction opens an earlier wound. Sometimes just a little scratch can open up a poisonous abscess of long-held anger. But there's another way that our ghost selves leak out, and that's when we connect with the world around us in loving and joyous ways. And our armor kind of just relaxes a little bit and cracks open up. Healing connections invite our ghost selves out to play with the natural world, with plants and animals, and with even one person who sees and accepts us. Our practice offers us the possibility of cultivating a mind spacious enough to include the totality of our lives, just as they are. When we sit in stillness, paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience with patience and kindness towards whatever arises, not grabbing on, not pushing away, sadness, restlessness, desire, anger, despair, even deep peace, we begin to experience the true boundlessness of our being. Our old, frayed, stiff armor loosens up. Sometimes it drops away, like a cast-off husk of a cicada. That's an image you often find in Japanese poetry. For a moment, or a few moments, you can breathe freely, unencumbered. Then something shifts and the armor's back. How do we deal with that frustration and disappointment when the armor tightens up again? Which is the real you? Let's see what Zen Master Mumon, who compiled that collection of koans, has to say. This is from his commentary. He says, if you realize the truth, then you'll know that emerging from one husk and entering another is like a traveler putting up at an inn. If this is still not clear, don't rush about recklessly. When you suddenly separate into earth, water, fire, and air, you'll be like a crab dropped into boiling water, struggling with your seven hands and eight legs. Don't say I never warned you. He doesn't really answer the question, does he? He just says, if you understand the answer, you'll also understand that emerging from one husk and entering another is like a traveler stopping at one inn after another. That sounds like a classic description of reincarnation, the soul leaving one body and entering another, but that's not really what the Buddha taught. You know, the Buddha taught that there's no separate self. So he didn't actually teach a strict theory of reincarnation as in the Hindu tradition. So that interpretation is a bit limiting, a bit too dualistic. Zen has a venerable history of commentators commenting on previous commentaries. So a commentary by Nyogen Senzaki, who was one of the earliest Japanese Zen masters to teach in the West, gives a wider view of this going from one husk to another image. He says what Mumon means is that the shell, the temporary manifestation of our life, can't particularize or pin down what he calls the universal body, or the eternal traveler. He calls it the eternal traveler. We also call it our true self, or big mind, or Buddha nature. So that particular shell that of each of us right now can't limit all that we are, or can't Yeah, I like the idea of pinned down. I'm like an insect pinned. Because that's what we tend to do. You know, that's me, that's not. But what he points out is we pass from one shell to another, not just from one lifetime to the next, but one moment to the next. We're continuously coming into being and passing out of being, like waves on the ocean, which is another metaphor that's often used in Buddhist texts. So each moment we manifest, and again and again. If this is still not clear, Mumon cautions us, we should not rush about recklessly, but settle deeply into our practice, paying attention, waking up to this life, just as it is, meeting each moment fully. Then letting it go. If we don't, he warns us, when the time comes for us to let go of this body and return to earth, water, fire, and air, we'll struggle like a crab dropped into boiling water. You know, it's true. It's true that there are people who seem to face death with composure and ease. And there are others who struggle against it to their last breath. What is it that they get or don't get? So Mumon still hasn't answered our question. I don't think he's going to. But he gives us a verse. And so let me read you his verse. The moon and the clouds are the same. Mountains and valleys are different. All are blessed. All are blessed. Is this one? Is this two? Now, just to show you how different translations from classical Chinese can be, I'm going to read you another one. The moon above the clouds is the same moon. The mountains and the rivers below are all different. All are blessed in unity and diversity. A little bit of explanatory. But you know that's not in the Chinese. All are blessed in unity and diversity. This is one, this is two. Here's one more. Ever the same, the moon among the clouds, different from each other, the mountain and the valley. How wonderful, how blessed. Is this one or two? Three versions. So let's let go of the fine points of translation. And let's just imagine the scene. So we're looking out over a river valley with mountains in the background. A full moon is shining over everything, with scattered clouds passing, now partially covering the moon and then revealing it again. This is the pure light of awareness shining on our lives. Sometimes the landscape is obscured by our fears, or that pure light is blocked by our fears, confusions, resentments, avoidances. But then they shift just like the clouds, inevitably. And we can see the whole landscape of our life, just as it is. The light of awareness shines into our most hidden places and our most exposed. So, are you your Facebook profile? Your professional identity? Are you your role as a parent, spouse, son, daughter? Are you the writer, artist, dancer, musician your heart yearns for you to be? Not one, not two. One self, many selves. If there were no contours, the particularity of your life, how could you see its true vastness? How wondrous, how blessed. So, thank you all. for listening. To be continued tomorrow. May our intention